Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
The American War in Vietnam was excruciating from start to finish, for combatants on both sides, for civilians in the path of violence, and for Americans who watched the carnage on living room TV sets every night for years. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Few people are eager to relive those years of sorrow and upheaval, but filmmakers Ken Burns and Lynn Novick realized it was exactly those stories, recalled by people with firsthand knowledge from both sides of the fighting in Vietnam, and the extraordinarily divisive debate over the role the United States played, those were the stories the country still needs to hear and to learn from. And so they spent more than a decade on their latest documentary series. 18 hours of film played out over 2 weeks beginning September 17th. It's called The Vietnam War, and Ken Burns and Lynn Novick join us to talk about it. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you for having us.
The Vietnam War was such a divisive time in American history, and Americans were rethinking everything they had assumed about their identities.
The Vietnam War is the most important event in American history in the second half of the 20th century, and a good deal of the divisions that we experience today, and are all of us, doesn't matter what our political persuasion is, are uncomfortable with, sort of had their roots, had the seeds during the Vietnam conflict. And so what Lynn and I felt is that if we could unpack all of that, if we could give voice to all of the participants and create a space in which all of them could mutually coexist without this binary yelling that we see today, right and wrong, good and bad, red state, blue state, kind of mentality that we see, that it may be possible not only to understand the extraordinarily complicated story that Vietnam is, but help us begin to heal and have the kind of courageous conversations necessary to heal that Vietnam, you know, set in motion for us. So our main job was to try to tell a complicated story. It was a divisive period, but the echoes today are so fresh.
The film interviews people in Vietnam as well as in the United States, which is a really interesting choice because as much as this was a war fought overseas, we think about it in terms of how it affected us. Talk about the importance of getting Vietnamese voices in this work.
No, well, I think for Ken and me and for our whole team, it was really essential that we not perpetuate some of the mistakes that America actually made in our involvement in Vietnam, which was not understanding who was our enemy and who was our ally. And I think too often when Americans talk about the Vietnam War, talk about Vietnam, we're really just talking about ourselves. And you can't understand a very complex dynamic that involves many sides without speaking to the people on the other side. And so we had the privilege of going multiple times to Vietnam and speaking to people there and doing the same thing that we do here. What was it like for you? What did your family go through? What were you fighting for? What was it like when you knew someone who was killed, or you know, when bombs fell on your village, or when you faced the enemy that you didn't understand either? And what we found most interesting was that the war is as unsettled and divisive and complicated for them as it is for us. And that was revelatory to us. And I think the chance to hear from many different Vietnamese perspectives as well as many different American perspectives, exactly what Ken was just saying about having room for this extraordinarily complicated conversation. And if we can do that in the film, we think we can also do that here at home once the film is shown.
There's a Vietnamese gentleman that you interview in the film, and he says the only people in Vietnam who are still arguing over who won and who lost are the people who didn't fight.
And that's really true, too. You know, that's what happens where we sort of hand a political baton off in our country, and it's quite often the folks that aren't experienced with it. It's just like, this is a controversial subject, but this is not a controversial film. It will be controversial, but only among those who don't watch it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That we live in a culture which has, you know, no compunction about reviewing books they've never read or reviewing film series that they haven't seen. And so I think it's really important at the basic level of your excellent question is that at the heart of things, we like to abstract and objectify war in a very interesting way. It becomes a kind of historical and political cudgel. But the actual reality of war, as soldiers and only soldiers know, is far, far different. And what we wanted to do is get inside their minds and their hearts and their experiences and just say what happened, what was it like to be there. And what you find is a different set of values that, very strangely enough, as divisive as we discovered in a revelatory fashion, as it is for the Vietnamese, as it is for us, we also found unbelievable similarities between the North Vietnamese soldiers, the Viet Cong guerrillas, the South Vietnamese soldiers, and the American Marines, and the Army guys, and the pilots, and the helicopter pilots. And so all of a sudden, you realize that they belong in a kind of select club, which is the experience of combat, which most of us fortunately don't have. But we, because human beings always go into war, are obligated to ask them the questions. And if you're as lucky as we've been, that they have been so brave and generous with their experiences, that you can begin to shape something in which you're not, you know, that Buffalo Springfield song, "Nobody's Right If Everybody's Wrong." What we decided to do was be umpires, to call balls and strikes, and to permit all of these diverse views and truths to coexist. And it is possible for divergent truths to coexist in human life. I mean, we all know that in our own relationships. It's only in the binary outer world where we feel compelled to say good or bad, that everything is black and white. And so the portrait we've tried to draw is complex, but I think compelling because it's familiar. You begin to see, you know, when a Viet Cong guerrilla, who's the enemy, suddenly looks through the bushes and sees the Americans grieving over one of their dead and goes tapping his forehead, it occurred to me that Americans have the same humanity as us Vietnamese, that they care about their dead. All of a sudden, you're in quicksand, and your own sorts of sets of expectations of the other are turned upside down. That's a good thing.
Since Ken mentioned music, it's a very important thread throughout this film. We'll talk about the soundtrack in a minute, but there's a lot of period music in the film.
Yeah, it was extremely important to us if you're going to try to tell the story, not just of what happened on the battlefield and experience of combat that Ken was just talking about, but also how it affected our country and what the experience was culturally. You cannot understand this period without looking at the music and hearing the music that the people were hearing then that was being created by some of the greatest artists. You know, this music is still important and popular today. Bob Dylan, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, these are great, Paul Simon, these are just incredibly visionary geniuses, and they gave us this gift of music, and we were so fortunate that through the incredible efforts of our producer, Sarah Botstein, we spoke to the artist or their representatives, and all of them said, we want to be part of your project, because our music was important at that time. We want people today to understand it, what we were trying to say, who we were speaking to. And we're not just talking about protest music, we're talking about just the popular music that gave voice to the feelings of the people, and country music, the blues, rock and roll, jazz. So it's a wide range of sounds, and every piece is carefully chosen, and you only hear a piece of music if it had come out already. So you will not be hearing a song that people were not hearing at that time. And you know, people were playing the same music in Vietnam as they were at war protests. So the music is kind of this glue that binds the people, the country together, regardless of politics. And I don't know, we have 120 tracks in the film. We think it would be an incredible playlist of just representing the time and how people felt and all the complexities that music can bring along with it.
I want to underline that a little bit, because people who don't make documentary films for a living might not realize how incredibly challenging it can be to get the music you want.
So maybe two or three of these tunes we could have afforded if they decided to go full fade
maybe,
on us.
Maybe, I doubt it, yeah.
And we have 120. And it just shows you. And I mean, when Abbey Road is saying, because Sir Paul and Olivia Harrison and Yoko and Ringo have said, look, we want this cut the right way, so we're going to recut this particular tune for you because you need X amount.
Time.
We're gonna do this cut for you at Abbey Road. So do you go, thank you very much, Sir Paul.
The film notes that from the U.S. perspective, the war started in secrecy and ended in failure. That may be as much as a lot of younger Americans know about Vietnam.
Indeed. And that's it. And you know, what's interesting is that I grew up during this period. I mean, it's very interesting that our writer, Jeff Ward, who needs, you know, so much praise, is in his 70s. I'm in my 60s. Lynn is in her 50s. Sarah Botstein, our senior producer, is in her 40s. And so we brought this really diverse sort of geological and geographical and chronological wedge to doing this film. And what we found out is I thought I knew a lot about Vietnam. I lived through it. I remember everything from the early, from 62 on, and I knew nothing. And so here we have a film that begins in 1858 when the French arrive, and the first episode quickly brings you up to more or less the present, Kennedy's inauguration, but you learn some startling backstory stuff that you had never thought of. And then each subsequent episode for the next three or four episodes gets a smaller and smaller time period where you're just in three or four months of time, and then it begins to widen out from the Tet Offensive back so that the last episode covers from the peace agreement in 73 up until now, today. And almost every day of working on this film, and we've worked on it for a decade, is revelatory in that you go, I had no idea. I had no idea. Basic facts about the war. So that I sort of feel like we've screened it for veterans. We've screened it for scholars. We've screened it for sort of people of a certain age who lived through it. We screened it for kids, and they're all going, I had no idea. And the style, Lynn alluded to the extraordinary talent and artistry of our editors taking all of this material, is that of all the films we made, this is by far the most immersive, the one that makes you sometimes painfully, but sometimes really feel like you're there. And it can leave you, some scenes can leave you out of breath just because it is so, we tried to say, what was the experience? And we've got people who are still, you know, in their 60s and their 70s who were there and they fought and they know exactly what happened. And we have triangulation of battles where we have a Viet Cong guerrilla on one side of the hedgerow and we have a South Vietnamese Marine who is going to undergo some of the greatest tests a soldier, I think, has ever undergone, and his American advisor then, because it's an early battle. And all three are talking about the exact same moment, the exact same hedgerow. They know exactly which helicopter got shot down when from this plantation. Yeah. And you suddenly go, oh my God. You know, as Faulkner famously said, history is not was, but is. And that's, of course, the dream of any historian, is to make, artist, is to make that moment come alive.
You know, I mean, we have found that, so we've ranged from 75 to 45 in our kind of core senior team that made the film, but we have people in our office who are in their 30s and in their 20s, and then some of us have kids that age, or just, you know, we brought people in, interns, and just people to watch the film and see what they know, and they often know just, oh, my dad lived through it, or it was in one page of a history book. And their reaction has been so gratifying, because I think they immediately, because of what Ken is saying, of how immersive it is, sort of get drawn into the experience of watching it. And then coming along with that is this rather rich and textured history lesson of the last 50 years of, you know, what's happened in America actually through this prism. And so, you know, we found like we didn't know the story, even though we may have lived through it. They just know something bad happened. But it's like another war. It could have been World War One, could have been World War Two, Vietnam. It's just another one of those wars that we fought. And this sort of opens their eyes in a way that makes them want to know more. And one of the younger people that came to a screening said after the episode, he went home and he called his dad. And he basically, usually he was in his 20s, he talked to his dad on the way home from work, how are you, how are the Mets, whatever. And they had a 45-minute conversation. Him asking his dad, wait, how old are you, you know, what happened, what was your draft number, what did you do, anyone, do you, you know, it opened up the possibility of a completely different kind of conversation. They talked for an hour. That was a few months ago, and he told me the other day that conversation has been ongoing.
My guests are documentary filmmakers Lynn Novick and Ken Burns. We're talking about their new series, The Vietnam War. When we return to the conversation, we'll talk about how Americans at home digested the war through footage on the nightly news.
It sort of speaks to, you know, in a democracy, this is a central question of the film, what patience will people have for the destruction of war? And if the cause becomes murky and you're not sure what you're fighting for, and you're seeing these images, and then you begin to wonder, is it worth it?
That's when our conversation continues.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick about their new 10-part PBS documentary, The Vietnam War. Let's return to the conversation when I asked them about how television coverage of the fighting affected the way Americans thought about the war.
This is sometimes called the living room war, or the first televised war. This was an era of extraordinary achievements in photojournalism. Throughout the film, there are scenes where the viewer is really tempted to turn away, but the camera never does.
Yeah.
You can't turn away. I know what you mean, and I think we've been very sensitive as editors in not going too far. We've left on the cutting room floor graphic material that you don't need to see. It's just too much. But we also have not shied away from what happened. And you're absolutely right. Sometimes the footage is so compelling and it just gives you that experiential feeling, but sometimes it's the essential, the DNA that a still photograph is to us, the power. And it's not just the famous photographers doing those iconic Pulitzer Prize-winning photographs of the Vietnamese girl burned by napalm running down the street, or the man being assassinated during Tet, or the woman in horror at the death of her friend at Kent State, all of those iconic images that are seared in our mind, and we do. But it's also, we've got the home movies, and we've got the tapes that soldiers sent back, and we've got their, you know, blurry, out-of-focus photographs of them on their bikes with their streamers on the 4th of July parade in central Pennsylvania. We've got, you know, them in their Boy Scout uniforms and with their mom and dad and playing with their G.I. Joes. And, you know, what we tried to do is say, yes, we have this great legacy, extraordinary legacy, because unlike World War II, when we were all, everybody was embedded and things were heavily censored, and more recent wars where the act of embedding is itself a form of censorship, you were just sort of free to roam and you could stumble across stuff as a journalist, or you could say, please, can you take me to where you're resupplying these besieged troops in the Adrang Valley? And suddenly the camp commander is saying, you know, here's how you load a machine gun. And he goes, you know, non-combatant, civilian non-combatant. He says, nobody like that in this part, son. And shows him how to clean out a gun and fire. And you get the sense of the immediacy of it. And at the same time, I think we did the due diligence. That's what 10 years provided for us, was this kind of ability to go back and find the home movies and find the scrapbooks and the pictures and to do the research in the archives about some of our characters, because they're interesting things. They think of themselves, and we made a decision not to film any historians or none of the famous people. So we went to John McCain and John Kerry the first day of production and said, we need your help, and they have been extraordinarily helpful, but we're not going to interview you. You're going to be in the film, John McCain, when you're shot down and fished out and are interviewed by a European broadcaster. And you, John Kerry, we're going to follow you in your brown water navy, but in your testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that you will then lead 37 years later, but we're not going to interview you. We're going to interview people that any of us could have had Thanksgiving with. So that you're not, it's, you know, we live in the tyranny of bold-faced names. They're none of that. You get to know all the presidents intimately because of the tapes. You get to know all of those people. But what you want to know are the so-called ordinary people. And you learn right off the bat there's no such thing as ordinary people. And they make this come alive through experiences that seem familiar to us. They come from high schools like our high school. They go to colleges like us. They have problems with their familiar relationships. And that was what we were dedicated to doing in all of those photographs, whether they're from the iconic photographers or just a scrapbook, made a difference.
Absolutely. The only thing I was maybe going to add is just that, you know, we are acutely aware of the impact of these images on people who weren't at the front lines, right? So seeing these horrible pictures and footage, we carefully sort of chose what we thought could go in the film and what was too much to bear, as Ken was saying. And we, you know, there's footage that was never seen by the network. There's footage that's horrible that the networks never put on. But there's also horrible footage, very graphic and disturbing, that they did. And I think it's important for our audience today to see what was on TV and what was in the newspaper and understand that this was the first time that Americans really saw the realities of war, like Ken was saying, because there wasn't censorship and because photographers and journalists could go everywhere. They took incredible risks. I think 200 photographers at least and journalists were killed during the course of the war, American and Vietnamese, as well as reporters from all over the world. And so we sort of dedicate to some degree the film to them because they took enormous personal risk to make it possible for us to tell the story and for the world to know what was happening. That said, it sort of speaks to, you know, in a democracy, this is a central question of the film, how long can the public, what patience will people have for the destruction of war? And if the cause becomes murky and you're not sure what you're fighting for and you're seeing these images, and then you begin to wonder, is it worth it? Whereas in North Vietnam, they had total control, lockdown, 100% propaganda. The people there did not see horrible images of war. They did not see their own dead. They did not see, you know, mutilation and just destruction.
Did not hear of a loss.
They did not hear of any, right, no battle was ever lost. No soldier ever died.
They just didn't come home.
They just didn't come home
eventually. So they had a much simpler narrative to tell their people. And therefore, it was probably a lot easier to keep that war going indefinitely. Whereas here in the United States, in democracy, ultimately, the truth filters back and, you know, it's a question for the leaders. They know from the beginning, this is not going to last forever because people will get tired. The people will begin to wonder if it's worth it. And that's sort of the trade-off of, you know, the balancing act that our leaders had to deal with. And I think it's fair to say the public eventually said no.
This war was very much also fought on the home front here in the United States. And we see these really interesting scenes of Presidents Johnson and Nixon. Johnson is on the phone accusing the media of lying, like I think
right.
he's drunken sailors or drunken
right.
soldiers.
Yes.
And then we see Nixon on the day of the national moratorium hold up in his office sort of writing notes to himself.
Right.
Yeah, don't react, don't do anything, don't panic, don't, you know, this. You know, Truman is interesting in this in a very small cameo, same with Eisenhower. Kennedy has a much larger role. But really, the two presidential stars of this film are Lyndon Baines Johnson and Richard Milhouse Nixon. And they are as fascinating and as complicated and as interesting and as flawed and as incredibly talented as any politicians in the 20th century. And I would say, of the great politicians in the 20th century, only Franklin Roosevelt is the more interesting and complicated, but they are right up there. And, you know, fortunately, Franklin could oversee the rescue from the Depression and the unambiguous
right.
Second World War, whereas these guys inherited a much more complex, asymmetrical war with using the wrong tactics, making decisions based on a tension between what a gung-ho military wants to do for a kind of total all-out victory and what domestic political considerations suggest. And in that tug of war is Shakespearean drama of the highest degree. And to our great good fortune, it's all on tape.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, no
Maybe
other
not
president.
Their good fortune.
You know what? If you have the good fortune to go to the Oval Office, they confiscate your cell phone so that no recordings will ever again take place because we know what it reveals. And there's no amount of after retirement books, no matter how many yeah. that you write, that can erase what these tapes say by both these gentlemen. And it is so phenomenally amazing. I mean, we think we know what those tapes say. And we heard the existence of the tape. We understood, for example, that was the downfall of Richard Nixon when the Republican leadership, Howard Baker and others, came and said, look, you're done. You know, resign or you will be impeached and will be convicted and removed. And, you know, the tapes are equally damning of Johnson. But the tapes came out the voluminous tapes came out in dribs and drabs.
Right.
And they were sometimes printed in the newspaper, in the Wall Street Journal, in the New York Times, and you read them, and sometimes a scholarly book would attempt to do them. When you hear them in the context of a narrative that we're trying to say, they're devastating. So just one example, there's a year to the day before Watergate. Many of us remember June 17th, 1972 is the Watergate break-in, and we understand that that was ultimately the undoing of the Nixon administration. But exactly a year before, there is a tape, June 17th, 1971, where he is urging the blowing up of the safe at the Brookings Institution. Go in, do it on a thievery basis, blow it up, get in there. And you, no amount of seeing that in print imprints the way hearing your president say that to a tape. And it adds a dimension to this story that, of course, is part and parcel of all the other domestic struggles that are going on within families, between a father and a son, between two brothers who have different points of view, you know, within a community, within the larger nation where you're having these mass demonstrations. It is, I mean, it was the world turned upside down for a while.
Something else that you captured here is the communications that soldiers had with their families back home, and it's really very moving. Some of them are saying, Mom and Dad, don't worry. Sweetheart, don't worry. I'll be fine. And others were saying, I don't think I'm going to make it home alive.
Right.
You know, we have found in our film in the Second World War, and again here, sometimes in what the soldiers don't say, it's extraordinarily revealing of how they feel. They're trying to reassure their family by just being very ordinary and just everything's fine. We had this for breakfast. We went out on another patrol. Nothing much happened. Everything's cool. And when you see in one of the stories that we tell sort of someone evolve and let just peel back a little bit and say, you know, I wish I could be taken off the line. I might crack up. You know, I'm not sure I can do it. That even just those few words, and then we hear from the family what it was like to receive that letter, because they've been getting these nice, cheerful letters all this time. And then all of a sudden, this letter comes out of the blue and you realize something serious is happening. I find it always extraordinarily moving to think about how these young men, 18, 19 years old, are trying to protect their families so that they don't worry and, you know, hold in for themselves the responsibility and the anxiety of what might happen to them. And yet, that's really hard to do. So every once in a while, it kind of breaks down. And it's really devastating, I have to say. And then we think about the Vietnamese. One of the Vietnamese soldiers we interviewed told us that his parents didn't receive anything from him for 6 years that he was gone. No letter, no nothing. So they don't know if their sons are dead or alive or what happened to them until after the war was over. So I think this question of communication and how people can stay sort of immersed in this experience of war while it's happening far away from them is profound.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Lynn Novick and Ken Burns about their new documentary, The Vietnam War.
In those communications, you begin to realize what is at the heart of the experience of war. You know, in the Civil War, we had our letters. We had the testimony of the people in World War II, hear their tapes with the soldiers and letters and their firsthand testimony. But what they tell you is that the experience of a soldier is different. And they remind you, first of all, that we are obligated to honor those people who fought. A mistake we made for part of the Vietnam War was directing the protest against the soldiers, and we'll never do that again. We've learned our lesson as a country. If there was one lesson that Vietnam permitted, is that we will no longer demonize the warriors that go to war. But they have a special relationship with experience that none of us who have not been in war have. We sit here comfortably talking, and we don't think that our violent death is possible at any second. But if you're a soldier on the line in Vietnam, that is your reality 24/7. And that is nothing that you can leave behind or come back to and sort of say, it's okay. And you do things and you see things and you do to others and you lose people that you know intimately, and that changes you. And if you do not add that to your story of war, you've failed. The Civil War soldiers, when they were in combat, said they'd seen the elephant. I assume that's the most exotic thing they could think of. And nobody else had seen the elephant except for them. And we now, from studying that war and World War II and Vietnam, particularly Vietnam, have this palpable appreciation for what it must be, because the cameras got really too close and the still photographers got really too close.
Yeah, exactly.
And so their memories and the bravery of their recounting bring us a little bit too close, and we can begin to just apprehend that just through that veil is an experience that we don't know, but we are honor-bound, duty-bound to respect and to exalt even. And so while the Civil War ended slavery and brought the country together, and World War II did all the good things that it did, ending fascism, we can't find in Vietnam that sort of super redeeming figure. But we can find in the lives of the people who fought it all of the heroism and all of the redemption and all of the possible reconciliation.
Yes, exactly.
that we would hope to find. And then it's as expressive and perhaps even more expressive than the other wars. Remember, World War II, we call the good war. It's the worst war ever. 60 million people died. It's not, you know, more Americans died in the Civil War than in all the other American wars combined. And yet Vietnam has this special, because of its proximity to us now, because of our ability to grab a hold of it, it has the ability to teach us, I think, valuable lessons that go way beyond what your political sensibilities are.
Yeah.
And that's the important thing that we've tried to do in this film. I hope that we've done in the film.
My guests are documentary filmmakers Lynn Novick and Ken Burns. We're talking about their new series, The Vietnam War. When we return to the conversation, we'll talk about how many of the details of the war mirror events of today.
We could have started our conversation, Chris, with me saying, we've just been working on a film for 10 years about asymmetrical warfare, about a White House in disarray and consternation about leaks, about huge, big document drops into the American public, about information that the government did not want known. We have political campaigns reaching out to a foreign government during a presidential election, right up to the moment of the presidential election. You know, we have mass demonstrations across the country in not only Washington, D.C., in cities big and small, and you would say, you've abandoned history.
Right.
You're talking about the current moment.
That's when our conversation continues.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick about their new 10-part PBS documentary, The Vietnam War. Let's return to the conversation when I asked them about how class affected who fought on the Vietnamese side.
We were surprised to learn, but there's new scholarship that is exposing some of the complexities of the war in North Vietnam. And in South Vietnam as well, slightly different circumstances, or very different circumstances, some of the same questions that happened, which was that, you know, the elite were not necessarily so enthusiastic about sending their young men, their sons, into what really was for them a meat grinder. I mean, their losses were catastrophic on a scale that we can't possibly imagine. The North Vietnamese lost 1 million soldiers out of a country of 15 million. So, I mean, you do the math, it would be, I can't even describe what that would mean here. So the chances of surviving were not very good. So to that sense, the leaders, some of the most important leaders, figured out ways to get their sons to go to Russia to study or to have a medical excuse, some of the same things that happened here. Some leaders' sons did go south, but it definitely was a phenomenon, and it made many people bitter and, you know, resentful that this could happen. And in South Vietnam, there was also, you know, a lot of ways to avoid the draft. And so you could pay off the recruiter, you could pay the salary of your child so that basically they didn't have to show up. There were all different ways to kind of get around actually serving in the military. And, you know, I think it speaks to the fact that these were horrendous wars that lasted a very long time in Vietnam. Really, it's a 30-year war. And so after a while, people probably just felt like, you know what, we would like our family to survive.
There were Saigon cowboys who were
right
around the biggest city in the South, clearly of draft age, should be in the Army, and they're not. And they have to do with the rampant corruption that was the South Vietnamese government's, plural, and its military. And many, as you'll see in the film, many brave, brave soldiers, and we tend to neglect, and because of our own, the way things turned out, it is in our interest to tell a story that accentuates the ineptitude of the South Vietnamese Army. And there is plenty of evidence to show lots of places where it was extraordinarily brave. But
yes,
as Lynn said, you have got things that human beings do when war is happening.
And that happened in the Civil War and it's happened in other wars, you know.
Mark Twain
right?
skedaddled.
Yeah.
That was what it was called then.
Right.
He had his first taste of a skirmish and said, nope, and left the Confederate Army.
Right.
What do they call this war in Vietnam?
The American War. So they've been, they have a very proud history and a very fraught history of having foreign invaders. And so they've
right.
seen the Chinese as interfering for millennia in their affairs. And they've had the French for 100 years, essentially, from the 1850s to the 1950s. And then we kind of, you know, the French broke it, we bought it. And our first episode is called Deja Vu because almost everything that happened to the French
yeah.
would happen to us in our experience. And we learned nothing from their experience, and there was nothing the French could tell us about their experience that would help us not make the same mistakes. And in fact, things like there's light at the end of the tunnel was said by a French general 11 years before the U.S. ambassador, Ellsworth Bunker, said it, completely unaware that General Henri Navarre had said it just before his troops were defeated at Dien Bien Phu. So you just sit there in our first episode with lots, you're getting to know lots of Americans, but looking at the larger geopolitical stuff of a post-World War II
right.
Cold War, proxy wars being a better way to fight rather than a hot World War III with nuclear weapons. And, you know, it's the same. And not only is it the same between the French and then, but you can hear the echoes of it now. And that's not our job. Our job is just to try to take these 100 people that we
right.
introduce you to and intertwine and interbraid their stories in a compelling narrative. But you can't help but remember that Mark Twain, who survived the Civil War because he skedaddled, said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And we can hear the rhymes today of what's going on. I mean, we could have started our conversation, Chris, with me saying, we've just been working on a film for 10 years about asymmetrical warfare, about a White House in disarray and consternation about leaks, about huge, big document drops into the American public, about information that the government did not want known. We have political campaigns reaching out to a foreign government during a presidential election, right up to the moment of the presidential election. You know, we have mass demonstrations across the country in not only Washington, D.C., in cities big and small, and you would say, you've abandoned history.
Right.
You're talking about the current moment.
You're in the news business.
You're right.
We're in the news business.
So many people have had the experience of visiting Maya Lin's Vietnam War Memorial and finding it much more emotionally affecting than they expected it to be. I wonder what the challenges are of conveying that through the medium of television, which doesn't take you there physically, but needs to take you there in this film emotionally.
So, you know, this is a really great question. Lynn will have her answer. But if you've got this extraordinary piece of sculpture, this extraordinary patriotic thing, you've got this war, you've got Tricia Reedy and our other editing staff, and we've used the wall from the very beginning of the film all the way through, but we don't mention it one second until we get almost to the very end of the film, and then we tell you the story about it. It's actually not hard. It's a beautiful thing.
Right.
We captured it in all seasons, and we asked everybody that we talked to in the film about it, and we found the footage, and it is hard not to understand that the wall is a physical embodiment of what we hope our film will do.
Wow, that would be a wonderful thing if it could. I remember vividly when the wall was, Mylan's design was chosen and how controversial that was. And at the time, I didn't really understand exactly what was going on. It was only in making the film that I was able to really appreciate why her design was so controversial, why she was controversial. And I think one of the really amazing things that has happened, which I think speaks to what Ken was just saying, is that over time, the wall has become one of the most sacred places in America. People go there who have nothing to do with the Vietnam War to pay tribute to someone in their life who's gone, or to pay tribute to soldiers who have served, or just to be present in the space where these people who died are being honored. It transcends the Vietnam War in some really interesting ways. And spending time there, you really feel that. And you see the things that people leave there. And it's all just detritus from all kinds of parts of life. I think what it offers and what she said so beautifully at the time was that she created this wall as a way to make you experience death. And that if you went through her design and walked down this path and the names get bigger and bigger and bigger, you will go through a journey and you will be with the dead. And she said, it's not going to be okay. Nothing can make it okay. And I think that's a very profound insight. We like to talk about closure and, you know, everyone's happy, live happily ever after. This is a tragic, tragic event for our country, for Vietnam. Even though they prevailed, it's still tragic. And so it's not okay. And I think she represented that in this way that lets us accept that. And it's very healing. And everyone who goes there feels that way.
Even and the people who hated the wall
right.
as an abstract idea and thought it was only glorifying the people who did and not
right.
the service of the people who did it, in our film become overwhelmed when they then describe their stories of going
exactly.
to the wall to honor a friend. And so you begin to see that it is possible, even in our sort of binary and oppositional world, that there could be something slightly bigger than the yes or the no. And that's what you look for. You know, we always talk about as a cliche, well, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Well, if this is the sum of the parts
right.
and this is the whole, what's this?
Yeah.
And in the case of the wall, it's her genius and our, all of the emotional energy that we as a people.
That's the thing, right? Because it's
in.
What she created, but then it's what people bring to
right.
it and what they take away from it. And I don't know that, I mean, maybe she understood that because is a genius. But even if she didn't, it has a life of its own.
Right.
And we were lucky to make a film that gets to end more or less with a scene about the wall because it really does kind of wrap everything together and, you know, when some of the people in the film who have lost family members talk about going there and seeing those names, I mean, it becomes this universal experience of how to honor someone who you've lost, how to mourn the dead, how to live your life. I mean, it covers all of those things. It's very special. And one of the things that we're hoping, we partnered with The Wall, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund. One of the things they've tried to do in this internet age is to collect photographs of everyone who is on the wall, so they can put them on their website. And we are hoping to use social media to help them do that project, because they don't have photographs for everybody that actually is there. They have the official Army photograph or whatever, but they don't have actual sort of human pictures of everyone. So that's, I think, this sort of sense of remembrance and what the wall represents, and what we can all do together, is an important idea that the film can kind of instigate or help with.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Lynn Novick and Ken Burns about their new documentary, The Vietnam War.
Working on this project for 10 years, I'm curious as to how you managed your own emotions and tried to have regular lives going home every day after being, you know, elbow deep in this material.
Yeah. You don't have regular lives. I remember in my very first film, I looked like I was 12 years old. I was working on the Brooklyn Bridge. I was trying to figure out how to write a letter to raise money, which is what we do way too much. And I said that we were not interested in excavating the dry dates and facts and events of the past, but we were interested in an emotional archaeology. And I want to qualify that word emotional, because for many people that means sentimentality and nostalgia, which are the enemy of good anything. But the higher emotions that we feel are really what it's about, the things that compel the relationships we care the most about our faith, about our patriotism, and those things are really powerful. And for us, we can think of no greater privilege than sort of dedicating our time to this, because it is it's not just an education. It's not us telling you what we know. It's us sharing with you a process of discovery. But more than that, something accrues in us over the course of it, over the experience of the emotions, over and over and over again, that sneak up on us still. I mean, we can be in an audience looking at stuff we've seen 100 times, and it still moves us in some powerful way. And as much as we would like to safely retreat to a world in which 1 and 1 = 2, always a rational world, we are in fact compelled by the improbable equation that 1 and 1 often = 3, and that's what we're looking for. We're looking for those transcendent moments, and they come in really unexpected places, and they affect us. And sometimes it's, as Lynn said, you know, you don't really know. Did Maya Lynn actually get it about the wall? Probably, but also everybody who's gone to it has added to it. Just as the fact that we've now finished our film, which after 10 years you'd think we'd go, fine, we are so grief-stricken. We cannot let it go. It's taking a kid to college and going, you're happy to be leaving us? You really want to go away from us? Don't you want to stay another 17 years?
We can work on it a little bit more.
Yeah, can't we do it a little bit more? But we do realize that the film doesn't belong to us anymore. And it belongs to everybody else. And everybody else will add their layer of emotions and reactions, good and bad, I'm sure. But that's lawful. And that's what happens.
Each of us has our own sort of what we bring to it, like with the wall. And I think for all of us, I know this is true for Ken, I think it's true for Sarah, for Jeff, and for our editors, the people that we've gotten to know over the course of making this film, it's a very close relationship, even though we might not meet them that many times. We live with them on screen. We think about their life. We think about what they have to say. We look at the pictures. We try to make their story real. And we sort of begin to really deeply internalize who they are, and they become family. And sometimes they may not quite realize it when we see them after a few years, and you know, they've maybe been busy and we've been thinking about them nonstop. And so they sort of get into our DNA.
Yeah.
And we never forget them, they just change who we are. I hadn't really thought about it until as Ken was talking, just what it really has meant to get to know these extraordinary human beings.
You know, Lynn will do an interview and I'll go and see the person. We live with this person for 3 or 4 years, then I meet them. Right?
Right,
or vice versa. I've done the interview, then Lynn meets them, and you're like, you're weeping, you're hugging them like you're, you know.
And they're kind of going,
it's like,
yeah.
Like,
right.
Wait a second. And then they see the film, and then all of a sudden they feel that. And so what we have the great good fortune is not only being able to turn out the films, but we enlarge our own family.
Right, it's beautiful.
And our circle of friends.
Well, thank you for sharing all the stories, and thank you for spending this time with us today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having us. It was a great conversation.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. Subscribe to the podcast and learn about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.